Hello and welcome back to Mac Power Users. My name is Stephen Hackett. I'm joined by my friend and yours, Mr. David Sparks.
Stephen Hackett, the guy who went and saw the eclipse, is here today. How's it going, Stephen?
It's good. The eclipse was incredible. I'm sure lots of listeners, at least in the U.S., maybe got to experience it. A large part of the country, I think everyone basically in the continental U.S. saw part of it. But we traveled for totality. It was very close to Memphis. We didn't have to go very far. And it was a great family trip. It was really awesome. But now I'm back and we're recording episode 740 of MPU. It's a good day.
Wow. Wow. And also, gang, this is it for the hats and shirts. If you want hats and shirts, this is your chance. You got to go. We didn't mention last time, the sweatshirts are also available. I am a particular fan of the sweatshirts, I will say. And I have ordered two of them. So there you go. What color hat did you get, Stephen?
I spend a lot of time. I said on the show, black's not the right move because then it gets hot, right? But the black does look good. But I ended up going with the navy. There's something about the navy and the new color scheme really spoke to me. So navy it was.
All right. Well, for me, it's gray. I think maybe because my hair is turning gray, I'm just figuring that's my color now. So I'll get gray. So I got a gray one and I got some sweatshirts. You can get them too, gang. I really like them because they're multicolor and they're threaded, you know, so it's embroidered with the multicolor logo. It's got the, you know, orange representing the new Mac Power Users look. And we got it extended to April 15th. So what you do is you pay your taxes and then you just run over and buy a shirt from the old Mac Power Users. Why not? Right?
There you go.
Okay. On More Power Users today, we have a guest with us today. We haven't introduced him yet. Welcome to the show, Lee.
It is an absolute pleasure to be here. Thank you, David.
I should say Lee Garrett. I mean, you're my friend, so I just said Lee. You know, you'd think I've been doing this 740 times, I'd get it right. But either way, Lee Garrett is the new, I guess, what we call you, the proprietor of Screencasts Online.
That sounds very British. So proprietor works for me. That's good.
Yeah, I thought so. You know, we got a class to join up every once in a while. Don is kind of stepping back, and you're stepping forward, and Lee's taking the reins over there. And we wanted to talk to you about that. Getting back to the point on More Power Users today, we're going to talk to Lee about how he thinks about new tech. Lee spends a lot of time studying what's new out there and sharing it through Screencasts Online. And I think he has some interesting insight to share. More Power Users, by the way, is the extended ad-free version of the show. You can get it. Just head over to relay.fm/MPU. You can sign up right there.
So Lee, David mentioned that you are, now running the excellent Screencasts Online. We want to talk all about that. But first, I'd love to hear more about your background, your education, how you ended up being in a position where you were ready to step up and take over Screencasts Online.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, I've got to say, this is actually quite a big moment for me because Mac Power Users is the first Apple podcast I think I ever listened to. When I first picked up a Mac. And that's not actually too long ago now when you consider what I do at Screencasts Online. So it was back in 2014. It was show 177. So, you know, obviously we're back in the David and Katie days with someone called Gabe Weatherhead. Do you remember?
Yeah.
David?
Yeah.
The Mac Drifter, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
So he was the Devon Think guru at the time. And I remember being blown away because he was like, you know, so eloquent about Devon Think, you know, really passionate about the application. And back then I knew that Devon Think was something that I needed. I remember hearing an ad spot for Text Expander and I'm like, you know, I've come from a Windows background and I'm thinking, what kind of sorcery is this? There's no way that an application should be able to do the things that Text Expander can do. And then you followed that up with an ad spot for OmniFocus. And I just at that point finished reading Getting Things Done by David Allen, and I was getting into improving my productivity, and I needed an app that would take everything I'd learned from that book and, you know, give me the ability to implement it. And, you know, what better app than OmniFocus for that? So, you know, I listened to the show and I went to the office I was working at the time and said, look, you guys, you've got to listen to Mac Power Users. It's stunning. And one day, you know, I'm going to be on there.
Well,
like, loads of laughter. They said, you're dreaming. You're never going to be on a podcast, mate. But, you know, here we are a little bit later than I planned. But 10 years on, you know, I'm quite happy to be here. I'll certainly take that as a win. So, yeah, it's wonderful being at Screencast Online. I'm sure we'll get into some details about the career path I've taken, you know, a little bit later. But at an extremely high level, it's been really varied. So I started working as a restaurant manager. I then became a school IT technician. I was a director of IT. I became a teacher, a mobile server engineer. I've been a solutions architect, a technical architect. I've been a productivity ninja. So coaching in workshops and seminars. I've been a keynote speaker, a project manager. And currently I'm freelancing as a program manager for a London borough here in the UK. I'm managing two programs of work. So one of those is an accommodation move. So basically we're moving 2,000 members of staff from one premises to another. So all of the IT elements that fit in with that, I'm in charge of implementing. And then the other project I'm running for them is the migration of 80% of their data center to Microsoft Azure, which is not without its challenges. So as well as this, as you say, yeah, I'm also the new owner of Screencast Online, because now, clearly, I don't work hard enough on those two programs of work, so why not, right?
Yeah. Well, you're in that phase. I mean, both Stephen and I went through it, frankly, where you had like kind of a career, but then you find yourself getting involved with this Apple stuff, and it just slowly kind of creeps in on you. So I imagine at some point we're going to have you back, and you're going to just be running Screencast Online. But just to step back for a minute, you do have a lot of IT experience, and I think that's a unique voice, because so often the folks we talk to on the show are so focused on the Apple technology that we don't often have people here that really have their hands in the PC world.
No, absolutely. So my first actual IT job working in Windows was in, I think that was 2004. And then it wasn't until 2014, as I say, that I actually picked up any Apple device, let alone a Mac. You know, I didn't get my first iPhone until 2014 as well. All of my qualifications and certifications, etc., it's all in Windows. It's all in networking. So Cisco switches and, you know, virtualization, all of those technologies. That's where all of my professional qualifications are. Apple, you know, I'm kind of blaming you for that first podcast that I listened to that you kind of got me into it, but
you're welcome,
also thanking Lee. You at you're the same welcome. Time.
Yeah. I don't think there's no blame there.
Were you one of those Windows guys like, I'm not going to go to Apple, walled garden, blah, blah, blah? Were you one of those guys, or did you?
Oh,
just
yeah, categorically. I hated Macs. And that was from a an incredibly sort of acute viewpoint, because I've never used one. It was just, you know, there was this long running PC versus Mac debate, wasn't there? That, you know, if you're a PC person, you know, you can't possibly entertain going over to a Mac. It's not, you know, it's not technical enough, etc. But, the way I actually got into using my first one, it was when I first started freelancing as a project manager, and I was working with a transport company in the south of England, and their managing director, it was all a Windows environment, like all the way through. And I was just chatting with him over lunch one day, and he said, you know, I really want a Mac. And I was like, well, what do you want to go and do that for? You know, what do you want to, you know, they're not proper machines. You don't want one of those. And he said, no, well, they look pretty cool, don't they? And, you know, I've got a couple of friends that have got one. So, you know, a little light bulb went off, and I said, well, you know, if you got one and you got me one as well, then I'd support you with it, because obviously there's no one in this company that can support you because it's a Windows only environment. I just said that as like a throwaway comment. And then 2 days later, I've got this brand new 16-inch MacBook Pro sort of sitting there on my desk. And he said, okay, you've made a promise. So yeah, I need you to support me. And then that's when I listened to your podcast, because I thought, I need to kind of fulfill my promise now.
Yeah.
And I haven't used a Windows machine since.
Incredible.
No word of a lie. I know.
I think there's a lot of people that have similar stories that, you know, you grow up thinking, you know, it's a toy. I had the same thing in the legal profession. I was already a Mac fan, but people made fun of me. I would go in court and they would say, oh, you brought your toy computer, you know, and it was so silly because, you know, I'd fire up Keynote and then, you know, gut them. And they never saw it coming from my little toy.
Yeah, it's kind of strange. When I'm working with different clients now, I've only got four clients that I freelance for, and I sort of rotate between them like a year at a time. I'll work for one, then move on to the other so that I don't end up staying at the same place for too long. And they all know that, you know, if I'm going to come on board with them, I've got to bring in my own kit and I've got to use my own stuff because I will not use. It sounds so hoity-toity almost, but I will not use a Windows machine because I can't be the best version of myself when I'm using one. All of my workflows, all of my systems, everything that makes me productive is with my Mac setup, pure and simple.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that because, like, I had heard from a lot of listeners saying, oh, you guys make fun of Windows, but it's a lot better now. And, you know, they've really made a lot of progress. And that whole thing about Windows being worse than the Mac operating system just isn't true anymore. And then my wife got a job where she uses Windows, and occasionally she needs help setting up an Excel sheet or something. And I go over and I feel like Windows still is kind of crappy. I mean, like going through it, like setting, doing settings and stuff, it feels to me like, wow, are these guys ever going to like modernize this thing? But maybe it's just me.
No, I think there's something in that. I've been sort of screen sharing with people because the projects that I run, obviously, they're Windows-based projects. So, you know, we're upgrading Windows Server. We're doing lots and lots of stuff in the Windows environment. And I'm seeing them when they're sharing their screens and how they're navigating through different systems, et cetera. And it looks easier than when I was using it, for sure. And there are some great things, like, you know, Copilot is fantastic. The Teams application on Windows is far and away better than the Mac version. I mean, on my version, when I'm in a call, I can't even put a call on hold. Whereas you can obviously do that on the Windows one. It is definitely improving, I think, without a shadow of a doubt. But it's just that, you know, the singing and dancing that you can do with your Mac with, you know, the macros that you can set and all of the different settings, all of the automation. I just couldn't imagine going back at all. Mm-hmm. But that's not to say that it's not got better, because I'm sure it has.
So tell us about Screencast Online and how you got involved with them.
Yeah, sure. So, what is Screencast Online, I guess, first of all? So we release step-by-step video tutorials that cover different applications, different software and operating system features for macOS, iOS, iPadOS and watchOS as well. And that's Don McAllister, for those who don't know. He founded Screencast Online back in 2005. And he quickly gained a cult following because of the way he was able to break down lots of complex topics and apps into simple terms, as well as having that, you know, that soft, silky Liverpudlian accent that he has, or Scouse accent, as we actually call it in the UK. And in February of this year, I took over, as we say, the ownership of Screencast Online after working as a presenter. I think I was there for around 6 years as a presenter. As we said earlier, Don's still around. He's still helping me. And more importantly, he's still producing content for us and is going to be until he decides that he doesn't want to anymore, which hopefully is a long time into the future. We release two videos per week. So on a Friday, we have a full-length video that's usually between 25 and 40 minutes, although sometimes they can be a little bit longer. That's usually my fault when it happens, to be honest, because when I'm investigating an app and doing a recording, I can get a little bit carried away when I start discovering like a new feature or something else that I want to share. But then on a Tuesday, we do a slightly smaller video. We call that a tip video. And this can be anything from 5 to 15 minutes long. And it's usually either a shorter coverage of an app that we think is worth discovering, or it may just be like a quick update or patch release for a larger app that we think warrants some attention. Or it could be like an iOS release, like 17.2 or 17.4. If it's got enough good features, then we'll cover that on Screencast Online. And it's not just me that creates the videos. We've got a team of experts that produce regular content, which is great, because I think it's important to have different presenting styles for different types of applications and hardware, I think. Members also get access through both the website and the app to a monthly magazine, where we have articles from some of the presenters, as well as, you know, a few comments from yours truly. And we also have in that magazine a consolidated view of all of the videos that have been released in the previous month. It's been around a long time, actually, the magazine, and it's still incredibly popular. So I've got no plans to drop that, that's for sure. Although it is quite amazing how much work actually goes into creating it.
Yeah.
And then as far as membership options go, you know, we've got one product that we release. You can pay monthly, quarterly, or annually for that. Obviously, the annual one offers the best value over the 12 months. The pricing's actually been quite static for a long time, despite the back-end costs going up, which now that I've seen, obviously, all the figures and the accounts, you know, they have gone up. There's no doubt about that. But despite that, as I say, we've not reflected those increased costs in the membership prices, and I'm certainly not planning to for the foreseeable future. I'm going to try and concentrate on making the content that we provide, you know, offer more value for that money and recruit more members rather than need to raise prices at this point.
Sure.
I hope that statement doesn't come back to bite me, actually. David, you're a lawyer. you can cover me.
As someone who just went through it.
It's hard. It's a balance.
It's always a balance. You know, our membership went up, and it's something we had to do for sustainability. Mm. But really what we found is that the vast, vast, vast majority of people totally fine with it, you know, understand it. I think we did a good job explaining it. And there's always turnover in a change like that. But but you know, you've just now taken the reins. Like you said, you're getting your feet under you and you're focusing on the content. And I think that's great. I mean, Screencast Online has been, I mean, for all the kind things you said about our show, which are very kind, like Screencast Online is in the same conversation 100% of the time for me. Like it's been around a long time. The content, the presenters, all of it is good. And y'all do a good job in keeping that content relevant and fresh. And I know just how much work goes into that. And I'm sure taking on something that's already up and running, right? You already have the schedule. You already have the presenters. You already have the audience. You know, that's a set of challenges that not many people take on. I certainly commend you for being willing to do it and keeping such a vital part of our community up and running.
Oh, I couldn't have put that better myself with regards to like the pressure that maybe I've put myself under, which I hadn't accounted for at the beginning. So when Don sort of gave me the call, you know, he said, you know, Lee, I need to have a chat with you about the future of Screencast Online. I thought I was just getting binned, you know, like maybe it's not making enough money and he's got to let the presenters go or something. You know, I didn't know what was coming. And then, you know, he said that basically he wanted to just take, you know, a little bit more time to himself so he could enjoy some of his retirement. But I didn't really know how to take that call because there was part excitement. Okay. So I knew it was an opportunity and I love an opportunity without doubt. But also there was part fear because how would I afford it? How can I keep going with the Screencast Online name? Because it's been going for 18 years and wow, it hasn't broken. I don't want to be going in there and, you know, giving it the kiss of doom. But there was also sadness, like, because Don kind of, you know, he is Screencast Online. You know, he had, you know, it was his baby. He bought it. He made it as big as it is. And I'm as big a fan of Don as anyone, I can assure you. So, you know, I didn't say yes straight away. Let's be very clear on that. I went home and I spoke to Kelly, my wife, about it. She gave me possibly the quickest no I think I've ever heard, which was fine because, you know, I was quite scared. So I wanted someone to take the decision kind of away from me. So it wouldn't be my fault for saying no. However, you know, we sat down, thought about it a bit more, worked out the finances, created like a pros and cons list, and I figured that the safe option would be to say no, but something in the back of my head just said, I knew that if I didn't try, I'd just end up regretting it. You know, I'm nearer 50 now than 40. Life is far too short and these opportunities just do not come along. So we had another conversation. I laid out the facts and figures to her and eventually we agreed that, you know, this is the opportunity we need to get some passive income in. And actually, eventually, I'd be able to reduce the amount of work I need to do and be more present at home with the kids and with Kelly. So, it took about 6 months. But in February of this year, we had a soft takeover of Screencast Online where I took over everything, but legally, it wasn't officially in my name. And then in March, the lawyers finally managed to get all of the paperwork over the line. And Kelly and I officially became the owners.
Well, I can tell you, being the person to follow Don is not enviable because Don is just such a genuine, awesome guy, but so are you. And when I heard it was going to be you, I was like, well, that's the right guy. You know, if somebody's going to make this work, it's you. You've got business experience, you know how to run a business, but you're also very, you know, friendly, kind guy, good teacher. And I just feel like Screencast Online could not be in better hands now.
No, that's too kind. That's too kind. I haven't paid you anything for that. I'd just like to clarify that.
But the, you know, so it was Liverpool, you know, so, but now you're East London. So what do we call it? From the Beatles to the Who? Is that fair?
You could say the Who. Yeah, they're definitely from down here. Yeah. Actually, if you want to be trendy, because I live in Margate, you could say the Libertines. So that's probably one more for the UK sort of side here. But yeah, because they just recorded their latest album in Margate. And yeah, I sound a bit like P-Dog. So yeah, that works.
Well, there you go.
This episode of Mac Power Users is brought to you by 1Password. Go to 1Password.com/MPU to learn more. I trust 1Password with all of my passwords, my logins, secure notes, bank account details, and more. And a new feature they outlined last month, it's in the labs sections, which is you can enable in the settings of 1Password, is nearby items. So with this, you can assign a location to any of your 1Password items. And then on the 1Password mobile apps, like on your phone, there's a new dedicated section on the home tab, and it will show up when those items are physically close to you. So you may think, well, why would I want passwords tied to a location? They have this example in the blog post about it, but it's one that I thought of as well, membership cards. So if you have library card information or gym card information, if you're like me, I don't want to carry that stuff. I have it all in 1Password with my information. So instead of like getting up to the counter and searching, I could say, okay, when I'm at this address, I want to see my library card. And then it'll show up right there in the 1Password for iPhone app. Super awesome. I love this idea. And that's one of my favorite things about 1Password is that, yes, of course, they are focused on security and making sure all of my things are safe, but also conveniently accessible to me, but surfacing that information in new ways. And nearby items is just a recent example of that and something that I'm really having fun playing with it. Again, you check out their blog post about 1Password Labs. I'm sure there'll be more stuff going in there into the future. Super cool stuff. So if you are looking for a password manager, look no further than 1Password. Head on over to 1Password.com/MPU. Link is in the show notes, to learn more and sign up for a free 30-day trial. When you're ready to pay, you'll get 20% off. Once again, that URL, 1Password.com/MPU.
Okay, Lee, when someone comes on the show, we got to prove they're what we call the MPU bona fides. You've, tell us about your Apple gear, Lee. Because we know that you've got PC experience. We everybody's looking at you a little askew right now. You gotta let us know.
Well, I must say, I didn't realize I had so much kit until I started listing it all down for this outline. Because obviously, I knew I was gonna get asked this.
That's how it goes, man. That's how it goes.
So I've got to preface this with, I'm lucky, right? I'm incredibly fortunate to have what I have here. Okay, I don't take any of this for granted at all. So first and foremost, I've got an M1 MacBook Pro. That's my workhorse. Even though it's only 16 gig, I did want to have more, but, you know, money, and all that. The roles that I have mean that because I need a lot of equipment, I can't just max out everything. You know, I need to be smart with the money that I spend and how I spec things out. So 16 gig at the moment works well. I've got no intention of getting rid of it yet, although when the M4 comes out, I'll probably be forced to have a look at the very least. I guess some of it depends on how much editing I'm doing at that point. Because right now, JF does most of the memory intensive work. But if we decide to split that up a little bit more in the future, then maybe I'll need to upgrade. But that's the beauty of Apple Silicon, right? There's a lot of longevity. And, you know, at the moment, I don't need to. So I may as well save the money.
Yeah. I mean, and I'm sure the M1 is going to be a very usable machine for a long time going forward. If anything, the memory may be whatever what gets you in the end. And but your setup is interesting because you have it open on a stand next to a studio display. I know some people do that. A lot of people don't. A lot of people just clamshell it behind there. What led to you deciding to put your Mac up on a stand?
So it hooks into a CalDigit TS4 for one, okay, which is one of the best bits of kit I think I've got, because it's just so fast and there's so many connections on there. The studio display goes into that. And then I've got an iPad Pro sitting on the right. Which iPad Pro have I got, actually? It's obviously, they haven't had the new ones announced, so it's the one before that. So is that an M2, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think M2. It's M2, yeah. Isn't it? Yeah, that kind of tells you how much I use it, to be fair. It's predominantly just a sidecar device and a media viewer. I do want to use it more, but I need to use my iPad Pro a little bit more. But yeah, going back to why I don't have my MacBook in cloud mode, what you need to understand is in my day-to-day contracting role, I'm in a lot of meetings, right? A lot of meetings. Like today, this is the end of my work day today, and I've been in back-to-back meetings pretty much all day. So when I'm chairing meetings, that means that information is kind of like my currency. So I need to be capturing, I need to be displaying, and I need to be retrieving information, and I need to do all of that really quickly. So in a standard meeting, I'll have a drafts note open on the MacBook Pro display. So I'm quickly jotting anything that I need. So I capture like on the left-hand side of my desk. Then on the studio display, I use Stage Manager, and I will have a split screen that's got Teams on the left so I can see everyone and see if somebody's like sharing their screen. And then on the right, I'm normally screen sharing a document myself. So it could be something like a project brief or a raid log, an issue log, something like that. That's always on the right-hand side, which means that the center of my desk is where I do my display. And then over on my iPad, which is in sidecar mode on the right of the desk, that's where Obsidian is. And all of the notes related to every project, every work stream that I'm running, they're all in Obsidian. So that's where I do my retrieval. So I capture on the left, I display in the center, and I retrieve on the right, which sounds simple. And that's because it is simple. And yeah, because it's simple, it works. It just works really well for me.
That's a great workflow. And, you know, we hear from people all the time using multiple monitors. Sometimes we hear people using two or three monitors. And that's really what it comes down to. When you can figure out a workflow on that second screen that makes it worth it, then it works. And I think it also has a lot to do with the kind of work you do. Because you're doing this project management stuff, there's a lot of times I think a reference monitor can be a huge benefit to you.
Yeah, no, it kind of falls down when I'm working from home. So at the moment I'm in my office, and you know, the office is not at home. This is an office that I lease. It's about 15 minute drive away from home. So I'm here about 70% of the time, and then the other 30% of the time I'm at home working there, or I'm at a client site. Now at those times I've only got the two monitors. So I've got my MacBook Pro and I've got my iPad Pro. And that's where I'm kind of thinking the Apple Vision Pro could have a real benefit when we finally get it over here, because I'm assuming, and you two will probably be able to back me up on this because you all validate it because you've got one. I'm assuming I'll be able to have pretty much any kind of setup I like, or I'll be able to mimic that particular setup and have a desktop on the left, have something in the center and something on the right to work in the same way. I'm kind of hoping that's going to be the case.
Steven, do you want to tell him?
I mean, you can, but you're rebuilding it all the time. It doesn't. Currently, Vision OS has no concept of, it has permanence in the sense of if you leave a window over your kitchen sink and go to the bedroom and then come back, it's still over the kitchen sink.
But we're expecting Vision OS 2 to kind of like
hopefully
mitigate against that, aren't we? That's the planning and that's the hope, isn't it? And I would imagine that that's roughly the time that we'd be looking to pick devices up here.
Yeah, sure. I hope so. I think that's pretty low hanging fruit for Vision OS of having some sort of continuity of setup. But you could, you know, one of the great things about it is you can have these mixed modes, right? So you could have your shared Mac display in the middle and like an iPad app on the left and Vision OS's native app on the right and kind of mix and match. And that's really powerful, but it is a lot of kind of back and forth right now in terms of setup. But yeah, like you said, y'all don't have it yet in the UK, unless you've smuggled one in. Mike Hurley.
No, I haven't done a Federico or a Hurley. I'm fine.
Yeah. but yeah, I think it could be something that could be interesting there.
But one thing you said that I don't think you should count on is like looking at your laptop display through the pass-through and then having a virtual display next to it, because the pass-through is not adequate to to look at a computer screen. So they either need to put two virtual PCs or Mac screens into it, or you need to work with Vision OS native apps along with one virtual Mac screen. As it stands, I don't know what the technical hang up would be with getting two displays. In fact, I think at one point I saw there was an app that was pulling that off somehow, a Vision OS app, but I don't know if it exists still or what the status of that is. But with the way you work, Lee, I think eventually what you really need is two Vision OS Mac screens. Or okay. The Vision OS apps need to be good enough that you can put them all up virtually.
That's good to know. I just want to try and have something that's kind of standardized between what I do at the office and what I do at home, so that when I'm at home, I can be almost as productive. I'm never going to be as productive as I am at the office with my proper setup. I get that. But just something that mimics it, so that I don't have to, if I'm working at home, like not schedule any meetings and, you know, just do completely different kind of types of work to be able to fit in with the context that I'm in. I'm going to try and avoid that, you know, moving forward if possible.
And as you have what I call the geek trifecta, which is a mouse on the right, a trackpad on the left, and a Stream Deck over the center. So that is, you've got all the buttons, I see.
Oh, without a doubt. Yeah, so the Stream Deck, I use that all the time. It powers my lights. So I've got a pair of Elgato key lights behind the monitor. I've got all of the main project artifacts that I need to refer to daily. They've all got individual buttons on the Stream Deck. So I just use keyboard maestro macros for those in the main because they're quite easy to set up. I've got a mute button on there for Teams, obviously one to turn the camera off and on. And I've also got some buttons that are dedicated to different people that I work with in my projects. So if I tap a button that's called Mark, for example, it'll open up an OmniFocus perspective that's got all of his tasks that are assigned to him, as well as an Obsidian note that I use to update his progress, etc. So I've got one of those for the six sort of core people in my project teams. So yeah, my Stream Deck's pretty cool. I quite like that. It's nice. And yeah, trackpad left and mouse on the right. It's the only way to work with ScreenFlow, in my opinion. It's just.
I want Stephen to note that Lee has now talked about OmniFocus and Obsidian multiple times, and I have not taken the bait. Just so we're.
I appreciate that. The setup looks awesome. There's a picture in the show notes, and if you get the newsletter, it'll be there as well. I'm struck by how similar our setups are. Down, I think, to the same desk surface. I've got the wider one, but that bamboo Jarvis / Fully desktop. It's an amazing place to work.
Did you notice the stands for the iPad and the MacBook Pro are exactly the same ones that you that you showed off in, I forget which episode of Connected it was, but you were talking about it when your desk was getting roasted or something, and you said. I picked those up because I thought, yeah, they're cheaper than the 12 South equivalents.
Yeah, and it's totally fine. Yeah. Like, you know, totally solid. Doesn't go anywhere.
Oh, they're brilliant.
You said that this is a workspace, you know, outside of the home. How much of this gets torn down, like comes home with you, or is this, or are you a pretty big believer in like the work stuff stays at work?
The MacBook gets undocked. That comes home. Everything else stays. Oh, and the iPad as well. But everything else stays. So if I need to do any spot editing on a video or something for Screencast Online, I may bring the headphones home, but that's about it. Aside from that, I really try and make sure that I utilize having this office as an office space that is just for work that can only be done at the office. Yeah. I don't really want to be taking anything home because I do two full-time jobs. I run Screencast Online and I'm a program manager at the same time. So when the kids do see me, I just need to be as present as I can. Which is difficult and not always possible, but I need to do what I can to minimize that. So anything that can be left here stays here.
You've got one last thing on your desk that I want to talk about, and that's the Ember mug. This thing keeps popping up for me. Please tell us about this.
I've just got to give props to my wife because she's amazing and she gets me. And I think she's still cross that she bought me this last year because nobody should spend that amount of money on a mug. There is no incident in life where a mug should have firmware updates going out to it. But my goodness me, you know, I drink less coffee because I've got an Ember mug. And I would say because it keeps it at the temperature that I want it and I'm not I don't make a cup, drink like a third of it, and then, you know, have to throw it away, make another one because it's gone cold, etc. I'll probably get through just 3 mugs of coffee a day now, and it's always at the perfect temperature. I've just had to actually today replace the coaster because something's gone wrong with the charging points on there. So one of them is actually broken off. So it's a bit of a sore point at the moment. Yeah, I've just had to spend £30 on a replacement coaster for it, but it's going to be well spent because I love my Ember mug. It's one of the best bits of kit I've got.
Stephen, I just sent you a text message, a picture.
Yeah, you did. It's your Ember mug next to the MPU Yeti tumbler. It's a good set of cups.
It is less than a week old. I just had a thing where I was tired of my tea being cold. And I've looked at these things for like 3 years, and I'm like, I cannot spend that much money on a mug. And I'm like, you know what? I'm going to spend that much money on a mug. And a week in, I'm like, Lee, I love it. I love this thing.
I did just want to cover one more thing on my kit, if possible. And that's only because Steven's here. All right. So I've got a Switch cabinet underneath my desk now, which has got a headless Mac Mini in it. It's an M1 Mac Mini. It's superb. I love it. It's a headless device, but it's my backup device. And I just need to check that my backup strategy is spot on because Steven's here and Steven's the backup king, right? That's how he is. So my backup device is the Mac Mini. It's got Carbon Copy Cloner running on there, and it's got a couple of SSDs hanging off of it. So that backs up all of the shows, all of the Screencasts Online magazines, everything gets contained on that external SSD and the internal drive. Then it copies those across to a Synology NAS device, which I've got sitting next to it, which is also in the Switch cabinet. The Mac Mini is connected up to Backblaze. So there's my offsite storage for both the internal and the external devices. And then the Synology itself is set to mirror to another Synology, which I've actually got at my house. So I'm kind of hoping that covers me in any kind of emergency. Does that get your seal of approval, or am I missing
a layer? That's pretty good. It's pretty good. I mean, you've got multiple mediums and you've got them in multiple locations, right? So if a meteor comes down from the sky and wipes out your office, you got it all at home. That's pretty hard to find fault with.
And you've got it in the Backblaze cloud too. Yeah. So you've got two offsite backups. Nice.
Indeed.
One thing you have, Lee, that I wanted to mention as well is you've got a studio display, but you've got a big camera on top of it. What'd you do there?
Yeah, right. Okay. So there is a reason for this.
You needed a good webcam?
Well,
hey-o.
You say that, Stephen, and I don't know if I take issue with it because I ordered the webcam when I ordered the studio display solely because I had read lots and lots of reviews about the camera just not being up to par. So the camera is a Logitech, it's a 4K Brio webcam. So don't get me wrong, it's solid. It's really, really good. But when I actually tested out the studio display camera, I was nowhere near as disappointed as all of the reviews seem to point out. Don't get me wrong, it's not as good as the one that I've bought. And when I do start creating some more talking head type videos, which is in the plan for the next few months, I do prefer the fact that I'm going to have the Logitech camera for that. But yeah, I don't think the camera on the studio display is as bad as the initial reviews were. I don't know if that's because firmware's come out since those initial reviews that have kind of improved it and improved the resolution, etc. But yeah, I don't actually think it's that bad. But yeah, I'm still going to use the Logitech one.
I think it has gotten better, and I think if you turn off some of the features of like where it center stage or, you know, kind of moves the photo around, I think that helps as well. But I think it's totally fine if you're just like doing Zoom calls and that sort of thing. But I think in production, like with what you want to do and like what, like David and I both have like real cameras hooked up with like HDMI capture, that is sort of the next level up. Yeah. But I do think it has improved since
it's
that.
It's great for casual use, as you say.
Yeah.
For casual use, it's fine.
I think so too. I do want to talk a little bit about that second picture. You mentioned your Synology and the Headless Mac Mini in this cabinet that's locked on the floor, and you've got a mic preamp in there as well. What prompted you to put all that in a cabinet? We often see people with, even in my own desk, right, kind of boxes and drives spewed all over the place. Sometimes people mount them under the desk, or if they're heathens, they tape them to the back of their iMac. But you've opted to put this sort of in a discrete, separate cabinet. It looks like it has maybe a fan or some venting in the top. What are some of the pros of moving some of that equipment kind of into its own place?
Well, this is totally coming down to my IT background now, because I worked as a network engineer for the longest time. So I was working with switch cabinets for maybe 3 or 4 years, basically just, you know, racking, mounting all the time. And I miss having a switch cabinet. I've always wanted one. I've wanted one in my office. And when I had this excess gear that was laying around and I didn't really have like desks to put them on, et cetera, it's just a better use of my floor space and my infrastructure here to be able to actually put them in a cabinet. It's fantastic. It's everything's in one nice, solid little unit. Yeah, the preamp itself is designed to be put in a switch cabinet, because that's why it's got the mounting rack kind of assigned to it. I absolutely love it. And because I've now moved it under my desk since that photo's been taken, I've got something I can put my feet on when I'm working, which is always an added bonus. So yeah, switch cabinets are great.
One of the challenges is you have a sit-stand desk with those cables coming out of it. And as the desk goes up and down, you got to account for that. But yeah, it looks really attractive. Well, like I said, it'll be in the newsletter and we'll put it in the notes, but it's just kind of a nice way to contain all that stuff.
Aesthetically, it looks really, really pleasing. And, you know, I'm quite a neat and tidy person. I do like having everything like in its place. I was very careful with the cable management here on the desk. Obviously doing lots of testing at different heights to make sure that there was enough give in the cables. I know you two mentioned this in a separate episode before, you know, making sure that when you set up your standing desk, it's got to be done properly. You've got to test it at different heights. So yeah, I'm pretty pleased with how it's set up, without a doubt. It's good.
This episode of the Mac Power Users is brought to you by Squarespace. Go to squarespace.com/MPU to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain using the code MPU. No matter where you are, no matter what you do, there's a point where you're going to need to put something on the internet. And the answer for that is Squarespace. Squarespace is the all-in-one website platform for entrepreneurs to stand out and succeed online. Whether you're just starting out or managing a growing brand, you can stand out with a beautiful website, engage with your audience, and sell anything, your products, services, and even the content you create using Squarespace. They've got everything you need, all in one place, and all on your terms. Their Blueprint AI and SEO tools make it so easy to get started. You can start a completely personalized website with the new guided design system, Squarespace Blueprint. You can choose from professionally curated layout and styling options to build a unique online presence from the ground up, tailored to your brand or business and optimized for every device. And then easily launch your website and get discovered fast with integrated, optimized SEO tools so you can show up more often to more people and grow the way you want. You can integrate flexible payments to make checkout seamless for your customers with simple but powerful payment tools. Accept credit cards, PayPal, and Apple Pay, and in eligible countries, offer customers the option to buy now and pay later with Afterpay and ClearPay. Did you know with Squarespace, you can make the most of AI, kickstart or update written content on any website, product description, or email with Squarespace AI, generating instant personalized results that know and show your brand identity. Explain what your site is about, choose your tone, and enter what you need to get, short or long form text. No matter the placement, Squarespace AI makes it easier to go live, stand out, and succeed online. I've been a Squarespace user since they first launched. I still have a Squarespace website. I think they're a great service. It's just so easy to make a beautiful looking website on the internet using Squarespace, and the prices are so reasonable. If you're interested at all in building a website and you don't know where to start, the answer is Squarespace. So head over to squarespace.com for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/MPU to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. That's squarespace.com/MPU. And when you decide to sign up to get that 10% off your first purchase and to show your support for the Mac Power Users, our thanks to Squarespace for their support of the Mac Power Users and all of Relay FM.
So Lee, we've spoken about your hardware, but let's get into some software. You're a busy guy. You've got client work. You've got Screencast Online. You got family life. And you mentioned something that, and I can't believe I'm the one saying this, but you mentioned Obsidian and you mentioned OmniFocus. And I want to hear about how you're using those things in conjunction with each other and sort of how you manage that. I mean, I know from my past when I did a lot more consulting, like you have a lot of things to keep up with for a lot of people sometimes. And every client thinks that they're your only client, right? It's like, well, no, that's not true. So you have to keep all this information accessible and organized. How do you go about that?
Spoken like a true pro. Yeah, you get it. That's exactly what it's like. It's really important to me when I'm working that I use as many kind of standard processes and systems as possible, because when I'm trying to spin so many plates, I can't be managing all of those plates in completely different ways. If I can be as standard as I can, then it's going to be a benefit. So repetition all the time. If I take on a new project one way, then I have to take on all projects exactly the same way, so that I'm never missing any documents, any key shortcuts. I have checklists and templates that cover pretty much everything that I need to do to execute a piece of work. And all of these checklists, as you say, are contained in Obsidian. So Obsidian is my app of choice for storing all of this. I do keep looking at Craft because our Screencast Online repository is being built there currently. It's where Don has handed over all of his existing documentation. And I would like the simplicity of having everything that I do in one place, but Obsidian is just too good for me to drop right now. I wouldn't be able to move away. So I've got template files in Obsidian for new programs of work that I take on, for new projects and for new work streams. And just to be clear on what the difference between those is, it's solely in scope. So if I use like a real world example of what I'm doing now, the main program that I'm running is, I've mentioned it earlier, I'm helping a London Borough Council move location to a new building. So just over 2,000 users, we're migrating the whole IT infrastructure. So all of their links, we're building new floors, we're building a new data center, new communications rooms. That's not one project. That is a number of large projects, which collectively form a program of works. So the program I'm running, I call that the accommodation program. And I've got an Obsidian page that just contains key information and links to everything that I need to run that program. So there'll be a section for the program brief, a section for budget information, key contacts, stakeholders, milestones. It's a bit like an index sheet, really, and it will have links to all of the individual project sheets that I will also create in Obsidian. And all of my programs will have the same kind of setup, all based from a template. Then next, we have the different projects themselves. So migrating the data center is an example of a project. Building the comms room is an example of a project. Decommissioning the old site once they've moved, that's another project. And I've currently got about 15 projects at the moment that I'm running that form this program. So that's another 15 index sheets in Obsidian for all of those. Then each project will have a large number of work streams. So if you complete all of the work streams in a given project, the project is done. So for migrating the data center, for example, I will have a work stream to carry out all of the discovery on what's needed to execute that migration. There'll be a work stream to get the resources to execute the move. There'll be a work stream to create the governance structure. You know, far, far too many for me to name now. But each one of those work streams will have their own individual Obsidian note. And that Obsidian note will come from just one template that contains all of the key information I know I'm going to need to gather. Whenever I process an email that's related to a work stream, I'll update the Obsidian note. And if it's a comprehensive enough email, I'll store it in DevonThink. And that brings me probably to the next point. Each Obsidian project sheet will contain a link to an OmniFocus folder and a DevonThink group, because those are the three core apps that I use to be able to run all of my projects. OmniFocus will track all of my tasks, and DevonThink will hold all of my documentation. So Obsidian's a bit like the front end, and then DevonThink is where everything is stored in the back end.
That's exactly the same system I use. You know, I mean, you and I have talked about it, but it's like kind of the best in breed all the way down the stack.
How do you manage the margins with that? We get a lot of questions about, you know, tasks versus calendar versus notes, and you know, where do things go? So I guess using that example, you're helping this organization move. You got to move the data center. In that is a bunch of different things you have to do. How do you know where a piece of information should go? And what happens, or are there moments that occur where something needs to move from one system into another?
No, there's not. I've pretty much got, I've got this quite nailed down. So each project that I'm running will have a folder in OmniFocus. Okay, it won't have a project in OmniFocus. It has a folder. And then that folder will contain projects that are actually all of the work streams that I need to work on. It sounds complicated, but when you see it, it's easy and it works well. And it's similar for DevonThink. So in DevonThink, each program is its own database. So I'll have a database for the accommodation move. I'll have a database for the move to Azure. But then each project is in its own group within DevonThink. And then each work stream will have its own tag, which is great from an organizational perspective. But there's one bit that I haven't mentioned yet that stitches all of that together. And that's a tool called Anybox. So Anybox is an awesome tool. It's a bookmark manager. However, I rarely use it for web bookmarks. I use it to bookmark individual files on the Mac. So whenever I'm setting up a new project or a work stream, I will add three links into Anybox. I'll add a link to the Obsidian page, where I'll be putting in all of my updates and information. And getting that link is easy. You just press, I think it's Control and K in Obsidian to get it to the clipboard. Then you open up Anybox and put Control V to paste it in. Then you will need to go into Anybox and just give it like a common name that you'll use to reference it. And you do that with Command and D. Very simple. Then I'll do the same with the OmniFocus link to the folder or the project. I'll get that added into Anybox. And then finally, I add the link to the DevonThink group or tag, dependent on if it's a project or a workstream file, that goes into Anybox as well. And that means whenever I need to access any information relating to a project or a workstream, like the next action, for example, or if I need to pull off a project brief or a piece of documentation, I can simply open up Anybox, type in the name of the link, and I'm taken straight there. And then to speed that up even further, there's an Alfred workflow that you can install if you've got the Power Pack. And that means that you can open them up from Alfred. So as one example today, I was chairing a meeting and somebody asked me a question about the MPLS install. They needed an update as to where we were. So all I did was I invoked Alfred. I typed in AB for Anybox. And then that gave me three potential options. Once I typed in the project identifier, which was for MPLS, I just typed in MPLS. And then that gave me three options. It says, right, do you want to go to OmniFocus? Do you want to go to DevonThink? Or do you want to open up your Obsidian notes? Well, I know that I needed to know what the next action was. So I went into OmniFocus and it showed me what the next actions were that were to be assigned. It's super quick. It really, really works.
It's kind of like you built your own version of Hook.
Well, Hookmark, it's as though you're looking at my outline, David, because Hookmark is what I actually use when I start stitching OmniPlan into that particular workflow. So all of the OmniFocus tasks have to come from somewhere, and I can't build a project plan from OmniFocus. That's just not what it's designed for. It's not what it should be used for. Now, OmniPlan is what I use for all of the projects that I run. So I'm a big fan of the Omni Group. I know OmniPlan isn't cheap, you know, I really do. But it really does what I need. And when you're running a large program and you need to drill down into specific information, the filters that you can build in OmniPlan are second to none. The reporting is great. It's easy to level projects, to be able to get resources, resource maps, define the critical path, all of this project management speak that probably bored of and don't want to hear. But it's covered really well with OmniPlan. And the way I use it is all of the major milestones and high-level tasks are stored in OmniPlan. And then I can use an application like Hookmark to be able to link an OmniPlan task to a new OmniFocus task. So they link together. So I've got real contextual computing sort of going on with that. OmniPlan and OmniFocus work together really well.
And we don't talk about OmniPlan very often because it is such a kind of unique app. There aren't a lot of people that come in to the show that have a real need for it, but you are doing proper project management. And you know, you get the Gantt charts and all of the management tools you need in a box designed by the Omni Group, which of course is very nice. Very pretty box.
Yeah, and we haven't covered OmniPlan on Screencasts Online, and I want to, and I know I could do a really good job of getting it out there, but I worry that there's only maybe 5% of our members that would want to know about it because of how niche it is. But somehow I want to be able to get something out there. Maybe I'll do something on YouTube instead or something like that. But, you know, I do feel like OmniPlan, you know, something needs to be, a lot more learning tools need to be out there for it. And I could certainly do that.
People are curious about it, though. I think, you know, even people that don't want to necessarily use it kind of want to understand it better. Mm. I don't actively use OmniPlan at this point, but back in the day when I did trial work, I used it in a unique way where I would put together an OmniPlan for a trial plan, you know, because there's so many steps involved. And I would print it at the beginning of the case. Once we filed the lawsuit and we had a trial date, I would tell the client, okay, here's the current outlook of what we can expect. And the thing that clients never understood is it takes 2 years kind of to get a case to trial. And when I would give them the plan, they would see why. They would see the deadlines, the expert witnesses, all that stuff laid out for them. And it was a way to kind of soften the blow. But then as the case would progress, I could update it and send it to them. But it was never used as a collaborative tool, which is really what most people do with this planning software stuff. I only used it as a demonstrative tool.
No, I've started using it myself now for Screencast Online, you know, in the background, because the handover from Don to myself, it was, you know, incredibly detailed, but there's so many elements that I need to learn, so many processes, so many systems. But at the same time, I need to marry that up with making sure that I'm recording videos on time and I'm keeping my own schedule. And OmniFocus is great for tracking those individual tasks. But when it comes to getting that holistic view of how I'm spending my time and making sure that I'm not over resourcing myself or over utilizing myself as a resource, OmniPlan is absolutely perfect for that, because I can create a filter to say, right, what am I hoping to achieve next week with regards to the takeover of Screencast Online? I could look at it and think, oh my goodness me, so I'm expecting myself to learn all of that and release these videos and prepare these marketing materials, and you know, it's just too much. So use OmniPlan to move stuff out into the future and make it a lot more manageable. It's great for that holistic sort of overview of your life, without a doubt.
Nice. But it is interesting to me, kind of winding back a little bit, you're using Anybox as your link manager, but you're also using Hookmark, or I call it Hook because that's what they've changed the name. I can't get it out of my head. But the Hookmark to tie different elements of OmniPlan to OmniFocus. So you're using all the toys, Lee.
Yeah, I am. But I'm trying to use them for specific things that I think they are best suited for. So yeah, Anybox is predominantly just for those three different links that I said earlier, for the main OmniFocus link to the project, for the DevonThink link to the resources, and the Obsidian note. And they're not really for very much else, just those. And then Hookmark I use for the more contextual sort of elements. So if I'm sitting there in a project brief for a particular project, and I know that I need to get to a resource plan for that project, it's easier to do that through Hookmark and link the two together and switch across contextually than it is to have the added sort of overhead of trying to manage Anybox for that as well. Otherwise, you could end up with too much in too many systems, and you know, you end up giving yourself friction. And friction is the one thing that you're trying to avoid when you're trying to be productive and do as much work as I'm doing.
Well, and you could argue that you are giving yourself too much friction, because you could use a tool like Obsidian to also manage your tasks and put your document attachments in, and you could all have it in the one place. Have you ever looked into that?
I have. I tried it for task management. I think it lasted an hour, and I then realized that it just wasn't for me. I need to have attachments for the work I do in an encrypted database, just because of the nature of the work that I'm doing. So I like having everything in an encrypted DevonThink backend that's stored on a encrypted SSD, which is where it is. So, I do have to be careful with things like that. So my hand is forced in some ways with regards to how I have to work as a contractor. I've got responsibilities to make sure that data's secure, et cetera. I know that Obsidian has encrypted end-to-end. It is encrypted, isn't it? If I was to use Obsidian Sync.
Yeah, if you use AirSync, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, I just love DevonThink so much that I'm just utilizing that.
And I'm like the same way. I feel like it's great that there are these tools showing up that can do everything, but I just want to use the best tool for each piece of it. And like Indeed. You, I've explored and experimented, and I keep coming back to these power tools. And so long as they've got a linking system built in, and DevonThink, OmniFocus, all these do have good internal and external linking built in, then I can cobble together whatever I need with the best possible tools. And
Indeed.
I think I've just kind of settled on the fact that's just my personality. I want the good ones.
Yeah, well, a one-size-fits-all approach for your applications and stuff doesn't always work, and you can end up just ending up working harder to be able to do something. Whereas if you can just use the right tool for the right task, it's just so much more efficient, in my opinion.
Another piece that you've mentioned several times is Alfred. And this is another one to me where it's just such a great tool because of its interactivity with other units. Like, you've got it working with AnyBox, but there's so many plugins for Alfred. I did a Max Markey Labs video recently on Apple Notes. There's a plugin where you can just type the letter N space, and then it searches Apple Notes and jumps to that note for you, which is just very fast if you're using Apple Notes. And like, whatever it is that you're doing, Alfred seems to be able to find it.
Yeah, absolutely. I use it for, I have to use it for currency conversion quite a lot when it comes to, paying some of the Screencast Online bills, etc. It's great for time zone conversions. There's plugins for that. I use the 1Password integration quite a lot because we've got a quite extensive 1Password database at Screencast Online. So Alfred is fantastic for that. I've got the shortcut of, Option Space and everything I do, I think I just start off with my fingers just going to those keys. And I've tried Raycast. I tried getting into that, but I felt like I was just trying to be trendy by doing that and moving away from something else that I was established and that I knew I was good with. So yeah, I went back to Alfred pretty quickly. It's what I know, and there's nothing I need that it can't do. So why change?
Yeah, I subscribed to Raycast when they did that, and I've been using them both for a year. I've got Raycast on the Option key and Alfred on the Command key, but my heart's kind of with Alfred, to tell you the truth. And the thing about it is, whatever I need Alfred to do, there's a plugin for it. I always find that does it for me. Like, there's some great Alfred plugins. Sal Zagoyne just made one for OmniFocus. And so it just feels to me like it gets into my data faster. Steven, are you on the Raycast bandwagon? What are you doing for launchers these days?
Every time I try something other than Alfred, it doesn't last very long, and I go running back.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, Alfred just, I think like you, it just clicks for me, and I've used it so long now, I don't even think about what I'm doing in it, right? It's just like my fingers are just doing stuff, and that's exactly what I want from a launcher tool like that.
The latest version 5.5 has got some superb AI sort of integration with it now. They've done quite a good job with the latest version. I'm just starting the outline for Screencast Online. We'll get a tip video out on that. Hopefully pretty soon.
I'm working on it too.
It's looking good. Oh, are you? Let's race. See who gets there first.
yeah, it's good stuff though. It's all good stuff. Yeah. The other app you had on here that I wanted to mention that I feel like we're going to be talking about more often is the Arc browser. That has just suddenly got so much momentum behind it.
Yeah, I'm trying to be careful with that because I'm trying to look at the direction that Arc is taking. So I'm not throwing my hat kind of fully in the ring with it. And when I finally get my hands on the Vision Pro, if there's no Arc browser on there, then I could find myself going back to Safari and just staying native, because there is a benefit to keeping all of your apps as native as possible, just because of the way that they talk to each other. But when, again, talking about the handover of Screencast Online once more, but one thing that Don was able to do, because he uses Arc and I was trying Arc out, is being able to sort of export all of his workspaces that he uses to manage Screencast Online, just send them across to me, and the way I was able to import them so simply. So I had exactly the same setup as Don did for his Arc, you know, within a couple of minutes. It's seamless. It's very, very easy to use. Some great keyboard shortcuts to be able to switch yourself between browsers. I love the way that everything's just in the sidebar, and you can have your pinned sites in the top left-hand corner that are persistent no matter which workspace you're in. it just kind of works with me, and it vibes with how my brain works for a browser. I tried going back to Safari, and I found it actually quite difficult to go back into Safari, despite the fact I've used Safari for what, like 10 years. But Arc just seemed to work, and I hope it's going to be persistent and it's going to be the app it should be. But only time will tell with that.
I also think this is a big poke at Apple to get the Workspaces thing sorted out, because they've danced around it in Safari for a couple of years now, but they really haven't nailed it, and Arc does. And I'm very curious to see what they do with Safari this year at WWDC.
Yeah, I think I've got 5 different Workspaces at the moment, and because I use a Logitech, what's this one? Just lifting it up now, it's the MX Master 3S. And it's got one of those little scroll wheels on the side, and just being able to use that to switch between your spaces is just so easy. It's seamless. You've got command 1, command 2, command 3, just like Safari, really. But to be able to get into your pinned shortcuts that are persistent, so it will command 1 will always be the same shortcut to open. It's just easy. Absolutely love it. But I hope it stays good.
Yeah, everybody's nervous about it. I'm not sure why.
And that's why I'm so reluctant to throw everything into it. But yeah, at the moment, it's also got great integration with tools like Text Expander. So, you know, you can just key in a shortcut whilst you're in there, and it'll automatically sort of launch Text Expander. It's really good. It's just, it does a lot of things right.
This episode of Mac Power Users is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Instead, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. So ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging, so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. I've done a bunch of hiring in my career, both at Relay and before. It is so important to find the right person. And that can be really difficult and honestly really time-consuming, but Indeed makes it easy. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it'll get. Join more than the 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of MPU will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility. Just go to Indeed.com/MPU. That's Indeed, Indeed.com/MPU. That'll support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Our thanks to Indeed for support of the show and Relay FM.
All right. So Lee, we've been dancing around the workflows you're doing in your contact work, and we've gotten to some of the details here with your app workflows, but I'd like to kind of get a little bit further into it. We don't get to talk to guys that do the type of work you do very often, so I thought it'd be fun to get through those roles.
Yeah, so what I'd actually quite like to do is like a little bit of a kind of like a history of like my work path that I've gone through so far, because everything is kind of led me to where I am now, but not everything that I'm going to talk about is kind of tech based. It's more things like processes and systems and things that I learned from an early age that kind of impact what I do now, and I think would impact anyone that's listening to this.
Sure.
So the first job I had, you know, it wasn't a tech job at all. You know, I started at McDonald's at like the age of 17, and I got promoted pretty quickly while I was there. I mean, I was the youngest store manager in the south of England, you know, which was kind of cool. Still quite proud of that. But why would I be mentioning my time at McDonald's on a tech podcast? And, you know, that's a fair question. But the fact is, my time there introduced me to two main concepts that have stuck with me until now. And I've used them in every single role that I've had since I left there. So the first is the importance of having processes, systems, and standards. So McDonald's, and probably not just McDonald's, but I'm sure any service-based company is totally built on processes and standardization. So if you order a Big Mac in the UK, it's going to be the same as the one that you get in France, which will be the same as the one you get in Holland, because it's the same detailed process to get that end result. And I remember vividly the tests that like each crew member would have to take in order to be considered proficient at a given station. And these tests would be the same tests that every crew member worldwide would take. And that's no mean feat to have that like level of standardization across the globe, essentially. And whether it was working as a McDonald's manager, an IT technician in a school, as a mobile engineer, or a solutions architect, a project manager, a productivity coach, you know, an online business owner, you know, these are all roles that I've gone on to do. But to do that, I've ensured that everything I do is based on making sure I've got processes, systems, and standards, which is what I'd like to think I've been reasonably successful at most of those. So McDonald's taught me that. But possibly more important than that was the message on how to communicate. So from the first shift that I did, communicating effectively was drilled into me. And that'd be the same as in any kitchen, any office, any job, I guess any industry. If you can name one industry where the ability to communicate doesn't have a positive impact on your results, be surprised. I'm sure there's one out there, but you know, I'm struggling to think. So I just want to share a couple of things that I learned about communication during my training there, because I honestly believe that it doesn't matter what profession the listeners are in, you know, these are going to help. So firstly, I was taught about the communication model. So the communication model is a four-step model to effective communication. If you take any of the steps out of this model, then your communication is going to fall down. And it's really, really simple. So step one is the sender. Okay, so who's giving the message? So in this example, of course, it's me, I'm the sender. Then step two, you need to have a receiver. So that's someone to be on the other end. So in this case, you know, it's you guys, or, you know, your seven listeners, or however many we've got. Joke, I know you've got tons more. Step three, you need to have the message, of course. Of course, it's got to be a message. So very simple so far, but you can, of course, go into detail on each of those steps. So for the sender, you know, you could ask yourself, am I the right person to be giving this message? Do I know essentially what I'm talking about? And for the receiver, you could ask, am I talking to the right people? Are they in a position to receive the message? And then for the message itself, you could be asking yourself, you know, is it clear? Am I using jargon words that people won't understand, or acronyms? But sender, receiver, and message are those first three stages. And then the last one is the one that people forget, and that's feedback. And if you don't get feedback on the message that you've sent, there's no guarantee that that message has been received, like end of. And I see this all the time. I mean, I've seen this twice just today in meetings that I've been on. And it's one of the downfalls, I think, of like email and instant messaging, because you'll send someone an email and then you'll just assume that it's been picked up at the other end. But if they don't particularly like what's in that email, or it may give them work that they don't want to have, you get the, you know, what email? Oh, I must have missed that one. I didn't get it. Can you send it again? You know, we all do that. We've all seen it, I'm sure. I see this at home in conversations with like loved ones as well. But I don't want to get in trouble in case they are listening, but just because you've said something to someone doesn't mean to say that the other person has necessarily heard it, right? So get feedback. And this definitely means that I think you have to be sure that the communication medium that you're using is suitable for the message that you're sending. Not everything is suitable for email. If you want a quick response, don't email someone about it. I think that's really, really important. No matter what job you're in.
I also think it's important that there be some communication in organizations to have that expectation. When you send an email, what's the expected response time? When you send a message, what's the expected response time? Or a Slack message? You know, you've got these different communication protocols. And I've always been one that does not rush to any of them. So there's always a bit of friction when I start communicating with people. They're like, well, I sent you a text message. I'm like, yeah, but I don't check text messages. Like, I don't have alerts that go off when they show up. There's a set time each day. I go and check them. But you have to like have those ground rules, or you really have a problem.
Yeah, 100%. Everyone knows in my project team that I check my emails twice a day. You know, I check it in the morning when I'm logging in and just making sure that, you know, I'm up to speed and there's been no fires gone on overnight. And then I'll check it just after lunch. just to make sure that nothing's coming over the course of the day. And then, you know, the rest of the time, you know, I'm doing busy work. I'm trying to get things done, as opposed to, you know, look at Outlook for when the cakes are in the office, or, you know, all of those other things that are disturbing you that you just don't need to know about. So yeah, it's important to make sure that you set those expectations for sure. And then another set of communication skills that I learned. Did you know that there are like 7 key skills for when you're listening to someone? Now, even though I learned these, how long ago was it? So this is about 30 years ago that I learned these. I still remember each one of them. And these work in all areas of your life, not just for your work. So 7 listening skills. We've got silence, which is perfect when you're interviewing someone, not necessarily in a podcast, but no one likes a silence. And when you're trying to get information from someone and you maintain that silence, it encourages the speaker to keep talking. You've then got reflection, which is where you repeat what the other person says. You repeat what the other person says. That's right. You repeat what the other person says. So that's the easiest way to show that you've heard what has been said. And then next, you've got paraphrasing. So this is where you repeat what the other person said, but you do it in your own words. So you're saying, I'm not going to repeat it word for word, but in my own words, so as to show I understood what was being said. Perfectly correct. That's what a paraphrase is. The next one is asking open-ended questions. So anyone can give yes or no answers to a question, but if you want to get some more information and show that you care about the responses and the conversation you're in, then ask questions that encourage thinking and encourage detail. The next one is your listening attitude and your posture. So make sure that you look interested. Don't stare at your phone, your watch, you know, no looking around the room. Just make sure that you're present, show that you care. And then the next two, we've got concentrating on what's being said. So try not to let your mind wander. Give the speaker your full attention. And then finally, we've got awareness of nonverbal messages, which is when people don't just communicate with words, but they use their body as well. So does the speaker look nervous? You know, are they uncomfortable? Is there anything you can do to make things easier for them? So those are the 7 like listening skills that I was taught. And I've been working full time in various jobs now for coming up to 30 years. And I can absolutely hand on heart say that not one of them has ever offered or provided the quality of management and communication training that McDonald's did, because I've used all of those skills throughout all of my jobs and all areas of my life. And I just wanted to say that and just impress that upon people that it doesn't matter what role you're in. It doesn't matter whether you're in the tech job that you want, or if you're just starting out, you know, there is stuff that you're going to be able to learn, whichever role that you're in, you're going to be able to take with you no matter what job you go on to do. Mm-hmm. I think that's important.
Yeah, I feel the same way about what I learned at the Genius Bar, you know, now 15, 16 years ago, however long it was, the way that I, you know, think about documentation and troubleshooting. Like I often fall back on those things that I taught. And that's true for many good organizations. A lot of good organizations instill these things in their people. And I think the trick is to take those with you when you move on, right? You're not at McDonald's anymore. I'm certainly not the Apple store anymore, but we are taking those things forward. And I would imagine now in your new role with Screencast Online, you know, coming into an organization, I mean, you've been in it as a presenter, but you know, it's different now, right? You own it, it's in your name, you're responsible for it, trying to coordinate with everybody and get content out there. I'm sure that these skills are paying off yet again for you, I would imagine.
And if it wasn't Screencast Online that I was going into, and I was going into another role in a completely different organization or industry type, those skills are transferable and they move me forward there without question. I just think that communication and being able to talk to people, understanding how you can define processes and systems, whatever job you're doing is going to help you. And not even just in your job, but in your life, in building relationships. They are such transferable skills, and you know, there needs to be more sort of focus on them out there. So I think I'm a reasonably good project manager, not because I've got a huge technical background or because, you know, I've had lots of technical roles. I think it's because it goes back to my management training at McDonald's that says I know how to build processes and systems, and I know how to talk to people and listen. And, you know, if you can do that, you can do almost anything.
Yeah. Process and systems, man. You're speaking my language.
Yeah.
So what other training did you get along the way that kind of gave you the documentation element of this? Because I've heard you mention that several times throughout the interview.
Yeah. So so as far as my technical qualifications go, I'm Windows qualified to the max. So I have got an MCSE in Windows Server 2003. I did that whilst I was at McDonald's, which is kind of strange because I needed to try and they reached a point where I didn't want to be sort of, you know, as a McDonald's career anymore. You know, I've got a big technical sort of gift, and I really just I've been into tech since I was seven, since I had my first like Commodore 16 and, you know, Spectrum computers. I've always wanted them. So I put myself through my MCSE, which was 9 exams. I then became qualified Cisco engineer. I became a qualified Cisco professional. I became a Cisco academic instructor. I did my project management qualifications. So I'm a PMP, which is a project management professional. I did my Prince 2 practitioner. Well, I did my Prince 2 foundation first, then became a Prince 2 practitioner. Did those about 10 years ago. So yeah, there's lots of studying, lots of qualifications. I dropped out of school reasonably early, but I certainly made up for it in my working life. That's for sure.
But I do think all of that kind of is cumulative, and you took what you could from each step, and now here you are as the head honcho over at Screencast Online, in addition to doing your contract projects.
Yeah, I'm kind of living the dream. It's almost as though every single job that I've had has kind of laid a little bit of a path and a foundation for the next one that I've had. It's almost like it's a predetermined path that I didn't realize was predetermined when I started on there. But I'm kind of excited to see where, you know, I'm going to be in 5-10 years time. I've got a feeling it's going to be pretty good.
I remember when one of my kids was a senior in high school, which is in US the last year before you start college. And
yeah.
I walked into the house and all five of them were sitting on the couch looking into space, just like worried, you know, and I knew exactly what was going on because my daughter and I were talking at the time about, you know, getting into college. They were all waiting to find out what school they would get into in their future. And I said, guys, it's all going to work out. Whatever you find out, you're going to end up where you belong. And I think your life is just one more example of that.
And that's exactly the message that we give to our daughters as well. It's, you know, you get out of life what you put in general. I know obviously obstacles can come along and, you know, things can be challenging, but, you know, nothing's insurmountable. And, you know, if you put in the graft and you put in the hard yards, then you give yourself more of a chance of being the success that you want to be.
The hard yard? Is that a colloquialism?
It's going to be a British thing. I do try and stop doing these British phrases when I'm screencasting and whatever, but they slip out. I can't help it. Yeah, the hard yard. Yeah.
Yeah, that means you're putting it, the hard yards. Okay, because I'm thinking of the NFL here, the football, like the hard yards.
Oh, yeah, I'm not thinking of that.
Yeah. I didn't think so. Well, every time we have a guest on, we like to have them call out some of their favorite apps and services that we didn't mention otherwise during the show. And I know you play with a lot of apps and services. So what are some of your favorites?
Yeah, so given the fact I've listened to Mac Power users for so long, we'll take anything that I've mentioned so far along with, you know, tools like Hazel, Keyboard Maestro, Better Touch Tool. We'll take all of those apps as read and just assume that I use them and I love them. So I'll talk about a few others now that may not be quite so obvious. Well, I say that ScreenFlow is possibly quite obvious, but that's our screencasting tool of choice at Screencast Online. It's just so easy to use. It's feature rich. You know, we get such value from the price. I can't recommend anything else at all. I know it's what yourself and JF use at the labs. It's just a great tool. I couldn't imagine not using it at all. One app that I do use when I'm recording my videos that I do get lots of nice feedback on is Keystroke Pro. Now, I know ScreenFlow does allow you to see key presses and keystrokes on screen when recording, but Keystroke Pro goes a little bit further in giving you like positioning and color customizations. You know, you can define exactly which types of keystrokes that you want to show. So do you want to show all of them, just those that have got a keyboard modifier? And there's more as well. They look really good on screen as well. And I like those. So Keystroke Pro, I think, is fantastic. We use Bezel as well now for capturing iOS and iPadOS. I can't believe how little latency there is with me performing an action on my phone and then seeing it on the studio display. It really is instant, and the quality of the output is superb, although it does make the ScreenFlow files quite large. I've noticed that, so they need to be compressed pretty quickly. But yeah, Bezel is a superb tool. Then in my day-to-day role, I do capture quite a lot of screenshots on the Mac, and I used to use CleanShot X for the longest time. And it's a great app. You know, the fact I don't use it anymore isn't a reflection on it. It's amazing, and it does help make setup great value. However, I covered ScreenFloat 2 recently on Screencasts Online, and it just blew me away. I mean, it's so feature-rich. Being able to capture just text, for example, it can hide all of your screenshots so that they're still there, but they're just hidden in the background while you carry on working, and then you can invoke a keyboard shortcut to make them all appear again. You can drag into apps very, very easily. You can annotate on the fly simply. But my favorite feature, I think, is the Shots browser. So basically what that does is it just keeps a catalog of all of the screenshots that you've ever taken for posterity. And I use that all the time because quite often I'll need to refer back to a screenshot that I took, you know, 2-3 weeks ago. And I know it's there. It's in the Shot browser. So yeah, ScreenFloat 2, I think, is a really good application.
Yeah. Everything by that group, by Matthew over at Eternal Storms, is great. They got Yoink, Transloader, which is a cool thing to like kick off a download on a remote machine. Lots of great tools there. I'm pretty in love with CleanShot X, but seeing this in your list as we were preparing is like, this is a guy who knows some screenshots. I should take a look at this too.
Yeah, but there's nothing to say that you have to use one over the other, to be sure. Fair. You can use the feature set, like even just hiding your screenshots. You can use that for certain scenarios, and then you can use CleanShot X for the rest. You know, mm-hmm. there's nothing to say that you have to use one over the other. That's for sure.
When I was doing my big macOS screenshot library a few years ago, and even now when I update it every year, one of the things that I have to do is I have to go into the command line and tell macOS, like, actually bury my screenshots like in the pictures folder. So they don't show up anywhere because I don't want them in like the download stack or on the desktop. And it's like, you know, this tool just built in. That's pretty cool.
Would sort that, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Right, so what other apps have I got here? I'm a big music fan. So I use Marvis Pro on my iPhone and iPad. I use that because they create really customizable playlists and widgets because it just has access to so much metadata. Again, we covered this on Screencast Online, show 1285. It's a really good app. I think it's about $10, but it's worth the money, in my opinion. Greg Pierce has just released Simple Scan.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, forever scanning apps seem to be great at capturing one thing and one thing only, and that was my money. Far too expensive, or they had free options that were just so convoluted to use with, you know, ads all over the place. Whereas Simple Scan, you just point, you click, you configure where it's going, and you're done. It's like the easiest lifetime unlock I think I've ever purchased. It's just superb. I know you've covered it, David, as well, haven't you? It's an awesome app. I can't recommend it.
I was just thinking about this app because I've been using it now as the mail comes in, and I'm thinking, do I still need a scan snap? Do I still need a document scanner? I mean, back when I was a lawyer, I needed one, but I'm not sure I do anymore. This app is that good for me.
If I had my camera on, which I don't, you'd see that my ScanSnap is currently sitting in a in like an open cabinet behind me, totally disconnected, and it has been for the last few weeks. So it's ironic you say that because, yeah, I'm not currently using mine.
I'd seen in the forums that a couple of people were having like some OCR issues with Simple Scan. I think Greg commented that he is working on that. But yeah, it's fantastic. I mean, actually, like just this morning, I had some papers from a meeting. I was like, I need to scan these. And like, you know, I get the flatbed scanner out, but it's a super easy to pull my phone out and use Simple Scan.
Mm. I'm very confident that Greg will release like 6 updates in the next week or something to make sure that it's covered. Because if it's anything like drafts, we'll be on version like 150 in by June.
Well, you've got one on your list here that I'm curious about, Lasso. Now, I'm already very much a Moom enthusiast, but I'm also addicted to a window management app. So tell me about Lasso.
Okay. So, yeah, Lasso. I love Lasso. It's a phenomenal app. It's my main window manager now. I've remapped my caps lock key to shift control command and option with Better Touch Tool. And then I've set the shortcut to invoke Lasso as just caps lock and L. And then I've subsequently configured the middle button on my mouse to that shortcut, meaning that whenever I need to resize a window, my hand's already on the mouse anyway. So all I've got to do is just click the middle button. A lovely grid appears and you can configure how many squares are in that grid. So you can make it as, you know, large or as granular as you like. And then just choose the dimensions you need and Lasso's done its thing. I've also got some configured predefined shortcuts with Lasso so that I can position the windows in exactly the position that I want. And I actually use the, because I've got a full size keyboard, I use the number pad for that. So if you look at your numbers like 1 to 0 on your keypad, if I press Control and 4, then what that's going to do is it'll move the window to the left-hand side of the screen. And then Control and 6 would move it to the right. Control and 8 would put it up in the top, in the middle. You know, Control 1 down in the bottom left-hand corner. Control 5 would put it nicely in the center. And then I'd use Control and 0 to make it full screen. So if you've got a number pad, it's a really useful and easy way to be able to set up your windows. So you can thank me later. It's really intuitive.
I will check it out. The Moom Apple script support is what always really keeps me there because I can script it so easily. But yeah, I'm going to check this out.
See, I never dived into Moom. I used Moom before Lasso, but I never dived into it enough to be able to leverage the Apple script support on there. And I think I'd rather not at this point because I've just found something that works well for me. I'll keep clear of it.
Yeah, I get it.
And yeah, there's one very obscure app that people may not know about, and that's Hand Mirror. So this is just a little menu bar app that just shows you how you look in your video. So I do quite a lot of video calls and I don't always look my best, if ever, really. And with this running, then you can just right click on Hand Mirror in the menu bar. Check the camera that you want to preview. So you get a little drop-down list so you can select whether it's your iPhone or whether it's your studio display camera or your external one. And then you just get a very, very simple preview of how things are and you can adjust without having to go into the app itself, you know, dummy launching a call or going into settings or something to look at how the camera looks. So yeah, Hand Mirror, I use that 3-4 times a day in the menu bar. It's a great app. And it's on setup as well, which is always a good thing.
Yeah, I just went and checked out. I need to just install. This has come up several times on the show. And my workflow is I open QuickTime and hit the keyboard shortcut, Option Command N to open it. It's just like, it's nuts what I do.
Yeah, I know. Hand Mirror circumvents all of that.
Yeah, I've just got to install this app. I just looked. Yeah, I already have it. I have a setup subscription. I just need to download it.
Yeah, it's a fantastic little app. I opened the App Store link to put it in the show notes. And one of the reviews is like, why isn't this built into the Mac? It's like, yeah, it should just be built in, but I'm glad it's not. So, you know, this app is out there, but it is very useful and surprisingly customizable for something that, you know, on the surface just shows you what your camera sees.
One thing, yeah.
I think I should have a filter to say, well, show me the best version of me today because I need it. How's that?
Yeah, I struggle with that. I don't think there's a setting available for me.
So. Yeah. All right. Well, anyway, Lee Garrett, like I said earlier, when I heard you were taking over at Screencast Online, I'm like, yes, Screencast Online has a long and happy future ahead of it with this guy in charge. I'm so glad that we got you on the show. You know, episode 177 was a long time ago. We're in the 700s now. We are not going to wait roughly 600 episodes to have you back. So plan on hearing from me. And we wish you the best of luck as you take over there at Screencast Online.
Oh, thank you so much. You know, I'm really grateful to be on here. Yeah, really enjoyed it. And yeah, it's certainly not going to be that long until I'm on here again. Hopefully we can talk about some more of the processes that that go on at Screencast Online once I've been able to onboard myself and I understand them a lot more. Because there's so much automation. You're going to want to know, David. I'm telling you, you're going to want to know how it's running.
Oh, I believe a process and system guy like you, after you get your hooks into it, it's going to change. It's going to be very interesting to see what you do with it. All right, we are the Mac Power Users. You can find us at relay.fm/MPU. Lee, where can people find you?
Yeah, so like most people, I've deserted Twitter or X or whatever it's called now. So at the moment, the best place to get me is on Mastodon, where I'm at leegarrett.screencastonline.social. And if you're a Relay FM member or Club Mac Stories member or a Mac Sparky Labs member, you can find me on those respective Discords as well. I do dip in and out occasionally. Not as often as I like, but hopefully more in the future.
Yeah, and go out and check screencastonline.com. That's where Lee is working these days. For more Power Users listeners, stick around. We're going to be talking about the way Lee analyzes and looks at some of this tech as he brings it into him. You can find that also at relay.fm/MPU. And thanks to our sponsors, 1Password, Squarespace, and Indeed. We'll see you next time.